Hi everybody, welcome to this Media Voices Conversations episode in partnership with Lotame. I'm co-founder of Media Voices, Chris Sutcliffe. Over the past 2 years, publishers have rightly been shouting about the power of their first-party data. Understandably, that's led to many becoming protective of the data that underpins that newfound, rediscovered strength. But rather than building up walls, many are doubling down on collaboration within the industry. So rather than simply hoarding that data, hoarding that strength, publishers are looking for ways to work with marketers to enhance their understanding of the consumer. So this episode is going to feature myself along with two experts, and we're going to discuss the importance of an open web to advertisers, the realities of this new cookieless ecosystem, the promise of identity and connectivity, and how identity solutions add value to the entire ecosystem. So to discuss all that, it's a small topic, obviously, I'm joined by Terry Hornsby, who's Digital Solutions Director at Reach PLC, and Chris Hogg, EMEA Managing Director at Lotame. So welcome to you both. So Chris, to begin with that, I wondered if you could maybe help provide some context for the discussion. And obviously, over the past couple of years, walled gardens have been one of those real, not just buzzwords, but kind of one of those realities of digital advertising that have made, that have completely, I suppose, saturated the entire discourse. So how have walled gardens really impacted the advertising ecosystem? And have they potentially prevented us from reaching the full potential of relevant personalized advertising?
Yeah, and it's a good question. And I think it really depends on what side of the market that you sit on. I think, first of all, I think going back, no one could have really predicted how much of a share of the internet advertising ecosystem that they would eventually, take between the different players in the market. I guess if you're sitting from a marketer's side of the thing, they're probably a useful tool to attract potential customers, although I think they even, drive some challenges there in terms of how can I connect the open internet with the walled gardens. They're quite disparate platforms that, as you mentioned earlier, that also like to put their arms around their valuable data assets and make it difficult for cross-market kind of penetration.
I was going to say that sort of typifies, every time I talk to people about it, that's exactly what they say when they talk about walled gardens.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think that's a reality of how they impact the market. But I think from a publisher side, I guess as well, they've had to sort of coincide alongside the walled gardens. They share customers. Most people are on some kind of social network today, mm-hmm. and I think from a premium publisher point of view, obviously they put a lot of resource, effort, money into content where the walled gardens don't necessarily have to do that. So there's kind of a disadvantage there in terms of the resources to actually bring this content to the consumers, and I think as a whole, I think it's difficult to live alongside these platforms, although they drive a lot of benefit to the industry. They're great sources to actually also drive traffic to other parts of the internet if you get the strategy right, but at the same time they do drive into revenue potential.
Yeah, that's been, I suppose, that value exchange has been at the heart of the conversation between these walled gardens and publishers. Terry, from your point of view then, how have those kind of walled gardens impacted how publishers think about advertising, and particularly digital advertising?
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't say unique view on it, but a more relaxed view than most publishers, I guess. From our side, we are one of the five biggest platforms out there with them walled gardens. So from our point of view, we partner with them. They do, as Chris said, they power the ecosystem one way or another, traffic, advertising. But I guess from our side is that, yes, they have got a unique ability to be able to change the kind of trend of the ecosystem. And that's something that publishers on their own generally can't do. And I think that's pluses and negatives. And we've had that over the past few years. But also some of the walled gardens are some of the biggest demand sources for publishers as well. So you're always conflicted in terms of, You like them, you hate them, you go through a love-hate relationship regularly. and generally, some of the walled gardens as well do provide genuine tools for publishers to use as well. And I think, to Chris's point, we do pride ourselves in producing quality premium content, and that is costly. And we obviously, as publishers, we'd all like more funding and revenue for that, and to be able to produce more of that content. And some of these platforms don't have to necessarily do that because they obviously use the content that we produce. So, but again, I think they are, over recent times, they are becoming kind of more partners in the ecosystem than kind of dominating. And I think from our views, I think a lot of, there'll be different views with different publishers. Small publishers probably struggle quite a bit to be able to draw up traction against these kind of walled gardens. But yeah, I think from my side, they're kind of, it's always a love-hate relationship. And yeah, we have a bumpy relationship throughout the years.
Yeah, that seems like an understatement considering some of the conversations I've heard. And yeah, I think it's important to mention, as you said, that there's nuance there. It's not as though, you know, all walled gardens are completely equal in how they deal with publishers. But as well as walled gardens, many of the practices around user data gathering and use have been completely upended over the past couple of years. So, Terry, from your perspective, what have been some of the biggest changes there, and how has the publishing industry responded?
Yeah, I guess the biggest change for us and for everybody has been this kind of the GDPR and the consent and the evolution of kind of the consent management platforms that all of the publishers have now, and gathering that consent and that transparency for users, and something I definitely agree with. I think it needs to be done. I think it's just the challenges we have over the next probably many years is that many users of the internet are not in our ecosystem or not in our industry, and they don't necessarily understand or want to understand or find it quite complex to understand some of the stuff that we do in the background and all of the tools we have to use to run websites. So I think from our view, and especially me, like 15 plus years, but before that, I kind of went on the internet and just kind of assumed that it was, yeah, just there. and I think that's the challenge. We are now kind of the forefront and saying, look, actually, it doesn't just appear, this is what we're doing, this is how we do it, can you help us out? And I think, yeah, premium publishers, I think, will drive that, and I think that's good. And I think it does allow premium publishers and premium platforms of content to actually stand out against the rest as well. So I think it's a good thing. I think it's just that we've had to adapt really quickly and quite fast. And
yeah,
our industry is so complex, it's ticking all the boxes. And how do we make it fit into a system that's been here for a long period of time? And that's the challenge we've got as publishers and independents.
Yeah, certainly that's been, if I think back to some of the guests we've had on Media Voices, they've said very much the same sort of thing. It was forced upon the industry in a lot of ways, but for the most part, it seems to have been broadly welcomed. Just maybe sort of some of the implementation hasn't been quite as in collaboration with the industry as we might have liked. So, Chris, you have a more holistic view of that then. What are some of those challenges that are facing the entire kind of ecosystem?
And I think everyone would be in agreement that, you know, the internet needs to be privacy first, and we need to put the consumer at the heart of that. I guess one of the biggest challenges at the moment is around who's the gatekeeper of the internet and who's the gatekeeper around privacy. You know, I'm a very strong believer in the open internet, you know, the open web. It was created for all, and, you know, everyone should be able to have access to the internet, but also everyone should be able to create businesses and have a fair advantage to actually thrive within those ecosystems as well. And I think, you know, if businesses are putting consumers first and it is privacy compliant, I struggle a little bit with the notion of, you know, big tech companies becoming the gatekeeper of that and sitting in between the publisher and their customer, or in between the brand and their customer. I think, you know, the customer has the right to decide who and who not to share data and share information with. And having big tech players in the middle that also have a vested interest into the internet, making decisions on behalf of the consumer around how they interact and what information. You know, I think that is a challenge in itself and is a threat to the open internet. The open internet still, you know, covers a very large proportion of, you know, businesses, you know, all the way from publishers through to brands, through to other advertising technology companies that work there. And I think we're going to see a mixture of two internets emerging. You've got the authenticated web, which rightly everyone's rushing to be able to have an authenticated audience base. But you're still going to have the rest, you know, not every user is going to be authenticated for everyone. And going back to your question earlier about the walled gardens, I guess they're at a slight unfair advantage there because their whole model has been built from day one around authentication. And some of the larger tech companies, you know, they have a lot more footprint around authenticated technology. So I think, you know, we are seeing the biggest change of the internet to date, probably over the past 2 years, with, you know, the likes of GDPR, et cetera, coming into place to monitor and put more control around privacy, which is the right thing to do. And then we're moving into an area around, okay, the technology we use to operate the internet, you know, with the detraction of third-party cookies is changing. And I think, you know, the next sort of 18 months is going to be very telling around how the internet responds and what the internet looks like. And I think identity is going to be a very big continued conversation that we're all going to be having.
Yeah, definitely. I wondered how tangible then is the danger, Chris, that it will be those big tech platforms that become the gatekeepers to that and sort of box everybody else out. What are the odds upon that being what happens?
I think the internet and the many different players in the internet are a unique set of businesses that are used to changing and adapting in a very fast pace. You know, the industry is still relatively young, I guess, if you want to look at that, although, you know, we are trying to strive to mature. So I think we're going to see a lot of new emerging technologies come to the market, and that open internet is still a very large base for businesses to be able to adapt, to be able to futurize and actually come up with better privacy first ways to manage where perhaps the third party cookie hasn't quite lived up to its expectations and hasn't quite worked, you know, in fairness to the whole of the internet, and perhaps, you know, consumers at the same time. You know, as we said earlier, you know, a consumer has a right to their privacy online, and if you build processes and technology to fit that, then I think there's a very healthy space still in the open internet for brands, for publishers, for tech companies, etc.
That's great. A little bit of optimism.
I think there is a lot of optimism, and you know, I think we should all be optimistic of what the future of the internet looks like.
Good, fantastic. And then Terry, you know, Chris just mentioned cookies then, and I mentioned kind of the idea that publishers have rediscovered the great strength of first-party data over the past couple of years. So would you say now that publishers are in a good position to take advantage of that cookieless ecosystem, or is there still work to be done to make sure that we are, you know, ready to take advantage of it?
I think there's definitely work to be done. I think it'll depend on the publisher. Mm. I think there's very, very clear publishers that have got roots to success in that part, and then also there is the open publishers that say, look, we don't know just yet.
Yeah.
And look, we have got a period of time before this kind of kicks in, but it is the time to discuss it, and it is the time to kind of then act on it. And as Chris said, lots of publishers are looking around kind of registered users, and that's a big strategy for us, and it has been, and we are being successful in it and producing really good products that people can register for. But also, that's not just the only answer, right? The answer is to look at partners, look at partnerships around that we can do, and as a conglomerate, as publishers, we should get together and kind of discuss it, work with each other on it, because it's not a unique problem to one publisher. It's a problem that's going to arise in the industry in a whole, so we're only going to solve it together. And I think that's been key over the last kind of, even during these weird times where we can't face-to-face meet. I've had regular meetings with publishers, open forums, publishers that we probably wouldn't have spoke before, and started chatting around kind of what are the options, what can we do together, or how can we work with people like Chris and Lotami, and how do we work with people and do use our first party data in that powerful way, because we know our users the best. We understand them. We have unique touch points with them. And our customer is, at the end of the day, is the main thing. And that allows us to then tailor make kind of that personalization, that engagement, that advertising, all of the different elements with editorial and commercial with them users. And I think that's the key thing, is that I think we will be in a place to take advantage of it. And I think some players, and I count ourselves in that, will take advantage of it earlier. But I think that's because we are lucky in the sense that we are have got all the touch points that we have. And especially with us as a national and a regional business, the regional local trust and transparency that we have with our users is definitely a plus.
Nice. Well, you've preempted about five of the questions that I'm going to ask later on in your answer there. I just wondered if maybe just to set the scene, we are going to talk about collaboration, but what are some of the challenges then for individual publishers around that? Is it investing in a tech stack? Is it a cultural thing? Is it, you know, educational when you go and talk to advertisers about what you actually have to offer? What are some of those kind of individual challenges that are specific to publishers?
Yeah, I actually think that one of the core things within the ID space and kind of this cookieless world is actually skill set. I mean, it's a relatively new skill set, because it's a relatively new problem / kind of hurdle that we're going to come across. So I don't know necessarily if smaller to medium publishers really have that kind of skill set to look at these problems in the right way, and I think that's where the collaboration happens. But yeah, generally I think skill set, I think also the unknown. There is unknown, and there's a lot of research to be done, and there's lots of businesses and as Chris said, lots of tech companies pop up and say, look, we've got the solution. And there's a lot of noise in our industry that we have to kind of get through to kind of work out what the real solution is. I think that's a challenge for publishers, because we get pitched to hundreds of times a day of people saying, look, we've solved the problem. And actually, when you dig down, they probably haven't. And for us, especially publishers that are kind of less got that skill set, they're going to be looking for that answer. So they might make a few wrong decisions on the way to the right one. And I think that's the challenge for publishers, is what decisions do we make? How fast can we make them happen? And can we learn from them to find the end solution?
Yeah, definitely. And I suppose that leads on very neatly to the next question, which is, Chris, do you think then that it sounds like a kind of radical reinvention, but do you think that the future of digital advertising is going to require that development of an individual user ID, or is that one potential path of kind of this forking way forward?
I think definitely in whether there'll be one individual ID that's kind of centralized across the whole of the internet, perhaps not, but I think there will be IDs that actually come back to the individual. I think one of the challenges that we faced with third-party cookies is third-party cookies is very much looked at a device. And I think the internet is moving, you know, through identity away from a device to actually to people-based. And I think there will be a number of different IDs that come into to play, whether they sit on the authenticated side of the internet or whether they sit on the open side of the internet in terms of looking at signals. But I think identity and being able to treat a person like a person is going to be key for the success, not only, you know, for you know, tracking, targeting, for attribution, etc., but also for privacy. Today, a lot of privacy is managed by cookies, and you know, without persistence against cookies, we are very fast going to become an ecosystem where a brand or a publisher will have to ask their customer every time they touch one of their digital points is for the consent. And it's like, hey, did I not give you consent last week, or did I not take away my consent last week? This is a terrible user experience. And people expect, you know, when they give consent or not give consent, they're actually doing it as a person, not a device. Yeah. So we as a business, you know, we're very much like we need to treat people as people with connected sets of devices, whether that's authenticated or whether that's using signals. We need to bring that together to have a holistic view of that user, all built in with consent, and consent really for the individual. customer and what organization they're operating or working with. So a publisher, they want to come and say, yes, I give consent to a newspaper, or I can give consent to my favorite brand, that when you see me or you see my devices connect to your digital properties, I'm happy to, you know, interact, share information, etc. with your organization. So I think it's going to be very important.
And how far away are we from having sort of universal agreement on what that system should look like? Or is it always going to be slightly proprietary depending on whose technology we're using?
Yeah, and that's a great question. And at the moment, you know, there's no real centralized kind of look at that. I know the IAB continue to look into that alongside other initiatives, obviously, like the TCF sort of framework. But I think you're going to see multiples come to the market, and they're going to operate slightly different. You know, we're trying to build an identity solution we call Panorama ID, where we invite multiple ID solutions to be connected. Mm. You're going to have, like always with the internet, you're going to have some walled garden approaches. You're going to have some open approaches, some cooperation between businesses. But I think it's still very early stages. It's organic. Not all of the questions have been answered yet. You know, we're still waiting for information on some of the big tech players and exactly what they're going to do and will allow within their environments. But I think for the importance of the open internet, you know, cooperation and working as an industry to deliver solutions that both satisfy legislation, satisfy end consumers, and also satisfy a way to drive revenue and get paid for putting that content out there, which is important. I think Terry touched on that earlier.
Yeah, and actually, to go back to you, Terry, obviously the consumer, the reader, the audience is at the bedrock of you know, any successful publishing strategy. So to what extent then does this process require you to almost go to your audience and say, you know, be very open about the fact that this is why you're potentially implementing these new solutions? You know, how open and how candid can you be in those conversations?
I think you can. I think you can be fully open with people. I think it's the hardest challenge for us and for them is to understand that the full capabilities of what we need to be able to produce the content that they love. And I think from a local level, we have brands that are trusted. And if you have brands that are trusted, I guess that conversation is easier.
Yeah.
I think publishers that don't normally talk to their users and don't really take the users for granted are going to have a challenge. But for us, the customer is key to us, and they are the ones that consume our content. They're the ones that allow us to produce that content every day. So it's about kind of explaining to them and not kind of overcomplicating it for people, and also just not trying to be clear on what we really need from them to be able to produce that content they need. And I think that's the key, is just that kind of open clearness, which will help that.
I suppose in a way then it's actually an advantage for local publishers who, according to, you know, outlets like the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism and I'm thinking about Nyman Lab, their research shows that people tend to trust their local titles kind of a lot more readily than they do some of the nationals. So in that sense, I suppose that if you have the tech available to you, you can have that sort of candid relationship with the local audience. That could be an advantage for those sort of local publishers.
Yeah, definitely. And I think we see it in our regional business and with our local titles, and when we launch new titles in them areas that we're not necessarily in print but just digital alone. Mm. And we see the engagement, the amount of page views that registered users and the amount of take up on new products and registered products that they do. So we've got some great Liverpool FC and Manchester United newsletters, and you see the engagement and sign up from the people from the MEN and the Liverpool Echo, and even wider audiences, but from the local piece, that they're trusted bits of content that they go to every week to get their knowledge, and being local journalists, being in the local areas and knowing local people is all always powerful.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Actually, speaking of that then, so Chris, how educated are marketers about what they can actually do with that first party data that publishers have access to. Is there a disconnect between what they expect to be able to do and what is actually possible at the moment, or is it more that they just don't understand the capabilities of data?
I wouldn't say they don't understand the capabilities of data. I think there's a lot of very marketers that are very data savvy. I guess at the moment it's a conversation that's still ongoing, and I think brands and marketers, the same as publishers, the same as tech companies, are trying to find their feet and put all of the jigsaw together and find solutions to be able to improve, but also continue to do what they do today. I think COVID and the pandemic, I think, sped up this conversation quite a lot. I think there was a lot of downtime, a lot of pausing in terms of advertising. And I think that's gave a lot of businesses time to really dig in and focus on what the future does look like. Is there a disconnect between publishers and marketers? I'd say there's probably a disconnect, across all organizations a little bit at the moment. I think marketers need to speak to publishers to understand what publishers can do. And at the same time, I think publishers need to speak to marketers and understand what marketers need. And I think that's the way to actually uncover, is there any disconnects today? And how do we actually work together? Because both organizations need each other to thrive on the internet. So I think there's a lot of collaboration, and I think publishers that do start to talk with brands might have a rethink about some of their strategies, and brands that talk to publishers, will have a rethink about their strategies. I think overall there's two sets of first party data there that both businesses will want to use and put at the forefront. But also I think there needs to still remain an open mind that other data sets will still be required to deliver successful campaigns and really get that panoramic view of the users.
So then, Terry, whose responsibility is it to actually get those conversations going, that collaboration? Is it on the publishers to go to marketers and say, look, here's what we have access to? Or is it on the marketers to reach out to publishers? Or is it kind of just about constant communication?
I think the communication, it needs to be constant once started. I think if you're a publisher and I've got fascination with data and personally I'd like to go to marketers and challenge them and ask them about their kind of audiences, because I think to Chris's point is there is first party data, and I think some of the challenges and some of the misperceptions that audience has or marketers and publishers have about data is that the data is set in a template. So a customer knows their customer, they know what type of customer likes their brand. But actually my challenge is in this ecosystem and this world of programmatic, you can dare to be a little bit different. So take your normal budget, slice a little bit of your budget off, and actually look for the people that you don't know. And that's the biggest thing that publishers can give to marketers is we can match audiences and we can say, look, here's your customers and they're on our sites. But that's great knowing that they're there, but who don't you know? And where's that one customer that you don't know that could end up spending a highly monthly amount with you versus somebody that you've known for years? And that's always been my challenge to brands, and I've done a few talks over the years on it, and it's kind of that looking for that extra piece. You don't know, like cookies and data and the way that we consume content allows us to know certain data points about people, and you get cookie data from behavioral, so the content you consume on a daily basis, we believe that we know your behaviors, but also down to the point of, okay, you've registered for a newsletter, right? And you might have registered for a okay newsletter on our sites, but what we can get from that is that actually you probably going to be likely to be interested in fashion and beauty and celebrity, and it's taking that extra step. And I think publishers can and marketeers need to work together on that, because there is so many different hidden data points out there about people that people you don't get from everyday consumption of behavior. You wouldn't know that I love supercars by my consumption because I don't look at them on websites, right?
Yeah.
I actually just drive them and I like to go and see them. And I think in this, and it's not all about the consumption that we have online as well. And I think that's the key thing is that publishers and marketers need to work on that together.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Terry. And I think, you know, with the different data sets and stuff that come together, not all the data that you need to fulfill a campaign brief is going to be in the same place. And actually sometimes it's not even online. And I think, you know, having that panoramic view of the customer, you know, combining first, second party and third party data and being able to append that to the campaigns moving forward is it gives you that full picture.
I suppose, like, Terry, though, that sounds like an awful lot of time investment there. Is there an early mover advantage in being one of the publishers who, as you said, challenges marketers now rather than sort of waiting for it to become the industry norm?
Yeah, I definitely think there is. And I think there will be, there always will be a proportion of people that don't want to challenge because they haven't got the same views. And I guess from my side, as I said before, the data fascinates me and it fascinates my team. So we as a team, that's what we enjoy doing. And I think from our side, we will always challenge and say, look, try this, try that. And you do, you have ups and downs and you have kind of guaranteed returns on some of the data that you provide, but you will always have that surprise. And that's the beauty of it, finding that surprise. And that's the bit that the marketers and the publishers find to an advantage for them as well, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're working with a specific marketeer, and you can find an advantage for you to over their competitors and yours, then obviously that's clearly something you want to work on. And that's where deep data partnerships come. It's not about sharing data and sharing insight about people. It's about actually communicating on what their beliefs are, what your beliefs are, what the user's actions are, and then also what's next. And it's not always what you believe.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. And Chris, you've got a sort of oversight of all of this then. So to what extent is it possible to replicate that kind of that first party advantage that publishers have on a national level down at that local level as well? Is it, what does that require? Because it's always been sort of from the conversations I've had, it's always seemed like the holy grail of being able to kind of really transfer that strength down to a local level. So what is, you know, is it even possible to recreate that there?
I think it is. And, you know, there's multiple ways to do it and different organizations come out in very different ways. I guess, you know, Terry and his organization has a great advantage that they're at both national and local, and, you know, they can bring those data sets together to have both conversations. I think if you're a local player in a silo, they still have quite a broad breadth of content, and they can still glean quite a lot from the users and have those conversations with the users that are coming to their properties. There are other success stories and, you know, co-oping of you know, data and different news groups coming together, whether it's at national level or whether it's at local levels, and actually combining data sets to be able to attract advertising spend nationally. So I think I think, you know, even niche publications today, you know, have a lot of advantage in terms of you know, they might not have the huge volumes of data, but, you know, they have a message and they have a data set and they have an audience that is going to be of interest to a certain brand or a vertical or an advertiser. And I think whether it's the local level, the national level, whether you're a niche, a verticalized publisher, you need to focus on those strengths and being able to deliver a message across all browsers and really maximizing the reach of your audience.
Well, did you use the word reach deliberately there, or was that a complete accident? So, Terry, you've had practical sort of hands-on experience in actually trying to do that then. What are some of the challenges in transferring that expertise down to the local level?
I think that the technology allows you to do it at any level. I think it's just it's a communication and finding the right solution for them local advertising at local level, because necessarily it's not the same as some big brand or big marketeers out there, and I think that's the key thing. And sometimes it's even more important to be more precise with that data. And again, the local side is always challenging, because again, it's about hitting the people at the right time. But the challenge you've got with any local or regional kind of activation is that not necessarily, you don't necessarily work where you live. And if you're trying to catch the right people, it's about the communication with the marketeers to say, look, actually, yes, it's great that you advertise in Birmingham because your business is in Birmingham and you want your users to be in Birmingham. But actually, 60% of your customers might not live in Birmingham and might travel in from other areas. So how do you attract that? And it's about working with local businesses, because sometimes local businesses' marketing budgets are more strained than national businesses, and it's about making it work even harder for them. And I think that's one of probably the biggest challenges. But again, that comes down to if you've got the right kind of tool set and the right kind of publications around it, then it's easier. And I think that's one of the advantages and one of the blessings I have as digital local for me is I normally got 3 or 4 sites that would service that one client. So for me, it's quite an advantage. But if you was a national publisher and you were trying to go down to that location level or that regional level, then there's going to be a lot of challenges.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, even as you were talking about it, even with all kind of reaches advantages there, I was thinking about how big a task that actually is. And it seems incredibly daunting. There's just something about the idea of trying to do data really well on a local level that seems a lot harder for some reason than trying to do it on a national level.
Yeah, I find it quite interesting, quite challenging. I think from my view, it's almost even a bigger success when you're doing it at that level, because the results can be far more drastic, right? If that small business uses the right data and you get 6 or 7 people in their shop rather than the normal 1 a week, it can be a drastic improvement for them. And I think that's one of the challenges, but also one of the really kind of go to work and enjoy what you're doing moments, when you turn at that local business or help that local business generate real revenue for them, and that's definitely one of the main points for me.
So then I suppose the question, Chris, is we've spoken about collaboration and the need for publishers to really collaborate with partners within the industry to make the best use of their own data. How far through that conversation are we? Is there a widespread recognition that we do need that collaboration, or are people still determined to go it alone and to really think that, you know, that is the best way that they can make use of their data?
Yeah, and I think there's two sides to that story. I think, you know, some people are in the camp that everyone should become a walled garden, lock down their data assets without an identity play through. Then you've got the other side of the market that thinks actually, you know, we need to put the internet open to all, and we need to have lots of collaboration. I think in terms of newspapers, I think, you know, we've been seeing it for a number of years now. You know, publishers coming together to actually offer a larger audience to combat against the size of the audiences for the walled gardens. You know, Ozone's a great example of that. Mm-hmm. You've got 1XL is another example of that. You've got big publishing groups that can also do that on their own, like Reach. You know, they are a co-op of publishers themselves. So I think we're going to see a little bit more of that. I think some of the smaller publishers are obviously going to want to align themselves with some of the larger publishers. Maybe interesting, we might see more acquisition in the publisher space. Who knows? But I think we're going to see more cooperation, you know, and that could even be, you know, technology businesses as well opening up and being more cooperative between them, you know, more competitors actually working together to actually solve some of the challenges on the open internet versus the walled gardens.
And Terry, from your perspective then, what does it take to actually get you, I suppose, into bed with one of the potential partners as well? Do they have to offer something new or just something that's tangibly better, sort of than you currently have?
Yeah, I think from my point of view, it's really about kind of that less of that sales pitch at the beginning of the product, sell to publishers. And I think from me, I partner with people that want to partner and feed back to each other. And we've successfully done that with Chris's business and others. But I think we from our view, it's about being transparent about what your tools can do and what they can't do, and what would they do in the future with help from us and from them. And I think that's what makes a partner stand out to me, is somebody that actually works on that two-way relationship rather than kind of one way.
Yeah, definitely. And then I suppose there's a bit of a final question in terms of kind of that collaboration between, you know, tech partner, agency, publisher and consumer, and basically everyone within the ecosystem. Everything is built on that trust aspect of having the consumers on side. So do either of you have any best practice for ensuring that just by, you know, putting something new out there and even educating consumers about what their rights are, how do you actually maintain that trust and without it becoming a sort of a conversation about them hoarding their own data?
Yeah, I'm happy to jump in. I guess from our view, really, so it is that conversation. It is about the kind of the less worrying about telling people how to do things, and actually listening and saying, look, this is what we're doing. Do you kind of follow? What's your views on it? And getting that two-way conversation, I think that builds trust. If you come out and you kind of then say, look, this is the way we're working, and this is the way you should work, that doesn't build trust. Mm. And I mean, it's really clear for us to go, look, hands up, this is what we're doing. What are you doing? Where can we learn together? And that really does build a trust for me. And I think that does for the wider business.
And how about you, Chris? What do you think about maintaining that trust and not having it become a very sort of mercenary conversation about just getting consumers to give you your data?
Yeah, well, I think first of all, as Terry mentioned, you've got to have an element of transparency there. You know, having the conversations of what you're doing and why you're doing them, and you know, what's the benefits of doing it or don't doing it. I think you have to treat the internet as people based rather than devices, and you have to put that privacy at the forefront of any product innovation, any business relationship, any partnership that you're going into moving forward.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. You make it sound so simple when you say it that way. And I suppose then, just to round the conversation off, what are some of the current digital advertising trends that we've seen that we can expect to continue or even accelerate over the next few years? You've both mentioned that kind of COVID has accelerated a lot of the existing trends. So what do you expect to be some of those biggest conversations we're still having in the next couple of years?
Chris, do you want to go?
Yeah, so for me, identity, you know, that whole space is going to continue to be at the forefront of what we do. Without identity solutions, the open internet becomes a very difficult place to transact. So I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of continued investment in that space. As I said, whether people are looking at it from the authenticated side or the open internet, that's definitely where I think you're going to see a lot of the technology companies spending their concentration. They are today, and they will continue tomorrow. But also, I think as more third-party cookies begin to leave the ecosystem, as you say today, you know, there's still a lot of third-party cookies, mainly through the Chrome browser. That's still a big part of how the internet works, but as we slowly start to see those being moved out of the ecosystem, you know, there's going to be a lot of products around how we can actually do some of the stuff we're doing today, and how can we actually improve privacy and have those transparent conversations.
Very nice. And Terry, what would, from a publisher perspective then, what are some of the trends that you're expecting to see that you can hopefully take advantage of?
I think definitely identity, and definitely back Chris on that one. I think from our view, my hopes and dreams are that we carry on talking about data. We talk about the kind of the extra layers of data, with contextual, etc. And publishers like ourselves that have created things like Mantis, which is the brand safety and contextual tools, doing more stuff like that with publishers and tech companies, and working out actually it's not just about people visiting the sports section or the celebrity section. It's about that extra layer of sentiment, etc., and also looking at other ways of joining up other data sets that we can help users and their experience on the sites as well. Because at the end of the day, the experience, the engagement it has to be there from our users and our customers, and we're only going to get that by providing them with more of what they want.
So as a final question, we ask all our guests on Media Voices, what was the last piece of media you read, watched, listened to that you really want to recommend to our audience? And I have sprung this on you, I realise, so if you do want to take a couple of seconds, that's fine.
I think, yes. Well, the last bit that I consumed was actually an interview of Bill Gates where he said about the impact of COVID, but it was filmed many years ago.
Oh really?
So I think that was the one where he mentioned that the world would come under a pandemic. So I was consuming that in the last couple of days. So that's probably one of the most interesting pieces for me.
Well, that's prescient. How accurate was he?
He was quite accurate, but again, all these things are quite broad, right? But
generally,
he was quite accurate, and I think that's kind of that's definitely the one for me. And if you're gonna plug any type of new content, it would be magnet fishing that I found on YouTube due to somebody recommending it to me, where you put a massive magnet in the lake and just pick up anything that it picks up. I've been watching that on YouTube recently as well.
Oh, I can see that being compulsive.
Yeah, that's very funny, actually, Terry, because I've seen a few of those clips. It's actually quite addictive to see what they bring out of the water. Never knew it existed until a couple of weeks ago. I think I see something yesterday. You know, it's just fresh in my mind. An organization called Biolitech. They did a very interesting piece of editorial around the role of a CRO and what they should actually be focusing on, and versus being the best dressed salesperson in your business, which I thought was very interesting.
Well, that is an awful lot of variety there in your recommendations. Magnet fishing to the role of the CRO.
Very nice.
Well, thank you both very much for appearing on this Media Voices Conversation special in partnership with Lotte May. It's been really interesting. I know that our audience will have a lot to take away from this. But for now, thank you very, very much for listening. It's been an absolute pleasure, and do stay safe until the next time you hear from us.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.